In Shakespeare's play, Henry IV longs for a worthy heir. Herod, in contrast, even when he was dying, could not in any way tolerate the quest for power of another and sought to eliminate his own son, even when he, Herod, had only days to live. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 72, Herod, Henry, and the Jerusalem Chamber. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It is one of the poignant political and familial scenes in Shakespeare. The dying Henry IV, torn with guilt over how he had himself come to the throne, places his crown beside him as he sleeps. His son, the future Henry V, on the brink of maturation from the riotous Prince Hal that he once was, thinks his father has died, and taking the crown, he ponders the responsibility that weighs upon he who must wear it, saying, "O Majesty, when thou dost pinch thy bearer, thou dost sit like a rich armor worn in heat of day, that scalds with safety. By his gates of breath there lies a downy feather which stirs not. Did he suspire? That light and weightless down perforce must move. My gracious lord, my father, this sleep is sound indeed. This is a sleep that from this golden wriggle hath divorced so many English kings." End quote. But Henry IV is not yet dead, even though Prince Hal does not see breath moving the feather next to his nose. And when the king wakes to find his crown missing, he takes this as confirmation that his son is unfit to rule, that he is immature and bent on power. The son, shocked to see his father alive, responds, "I never thought to hear you speak again." And to this the king replies, "Thy wish was father, Harry, to that thought. I stay too long by thee, I weary thee. Dost thou so hunger for mine empty chair that thou wilt needs invest thee with my honors before thy hour be ripe? O foolish youth! Thou seekest the greatness that will overwhelm thee. Stay but a little, for my cloud of dignity is held from falling with so weak a wind that it will quickly drop. My day is dim. Thou hast stolen that which after some few hours were thine without offense, and at my death thou hast sealed up my expectation. Thy life did manifest thou lovest me not, and thou wilt have me die assured of it." At this terrible moment, the prince assures his father that he had no interest in seizing the throne. Rather, he had taken the crown in awe at all that it embodied. Speaking of the crown, the prince says, "Thus, my most royal liege, accusing it, I put it on my head to try with it as with an enemy that had before my face murdered my father, the quarrel of a true inheritor. But if it did infect my blood with joy or swell my thoughts to any strain of pride, if any rebel or vain spirit of mine did with the least affection of a welcome give entertainment to the might of it, let God forever keep it from my head, and make me as the poorest vassal is, that doth with awe and terror kneel to it." In that moment, the king in gratitude realizes that finally his son, whose wild ways and gallivanting with Falstaff had caused him such dismay, was finally ready to rule. In the prince's awe at the responsibility of kingship, and in his thoughtful pondering of the crown, the prince had proven himself worthy of becoming king. This, in turn, sets the stage for Act 5 in the play, where the new young king, following the passing of his father, rejects the influences of his youth and ascends the throne. The crown scene is a fascinating one, which joins tension between father and son, ruler and successor, with reflections on parenthood and power. And it is even more striking when one realizes that in Jerusalem, centuries before there were English kings, a scene like this unfolded only in a certain sense in reverse, highlighting at that moment the unfitness of those who ruled in that age in the sacred city. We have seen how Herod's original apparent heirs had been the two sons born him by the Hasmonean princess Mariam, Alexander and Aristobulus, and how they were ultimately executed by their father. Herod's oldest son, Antipater, born by Doris, the woman he married before Mariam, was therefore, following the execution of Mariam's children, seen as the heir apparent. But, as Simon Sebag Montefiore puts it, quote, "There were many other sons available to inherit the kingdom, and Herod's sister Salome started to plot against him. She found a servant who claimed that Antipater was planning to poison Herod with a mysterious drug. Antipater, who was in Rome meeting with Augustus, rushed home and galloped to the palace in Jerusalem, but he was arrested there before he could reach his father." End quote. Prince Antipater was placed in prison while a mysterious illness consumed the king. Here is part of Josephus's gruesome description of Herod's physical state. Quote, But now Herod's distemper greatly increased upon him after a severe manner, and this by God's judgment upon him for his sins. For a fire glowed in him slowly, which did not so much appear to the touch outwardly as it augmented his pains inwardly. For it brought upon him a vehement appetite to eating, which he could not avoid to supply with one sort of food or other. His entrails were also exulcerated, and the chief violence of his pain lay on his colon. An aqueous and transparent liquor also had settled itself about his feet, and a like matter afflicted him at the bottom of his belly. And Josephus a bit later adds, it was said by those who pretended to divine and who were endued with wisdom to foretell such things, that God inflicted this punishment on the king on account of his great impiety. Yet was he still in hopes of recovering, though his afflictions seemed greater than anyone could bear. End quote. At one point in terrible pain, Herod, Josephus writes, took a knife with which he was eating an apple and attempted to end his own life. This, Josephus describes, set in motion a scene in which Herod's eldest son thought immediately of the possibility of gaining power. Describing Herod, Josephus writes, quote, when he had got the knife, he looked about and had a mind to stab himself with it. And he had done it, had not his first cousin, Achiabus, prevented him and held his hand and cried out loudly. Whereupon a woeful lamentation echoed through the palace and a great tumult was made, as if the king were dead, upon which Antipater, who verily believed his father was deceased, grew bold in his discourse, as hoping to be immediately and entirely released from his bonds and to take the kingdom into his hands without any more ado. So he discoursed with the jailer about letting him go, and in that case promised him great things both now and hereafter, as if that were the only thing now in question. But the jailer did not only refuse to do what Antipater would have him, but informed the king of his intentions and how many solicitations he had from him of that nature. Hereupon Herod, who had formerly no affection nor goodwill towards his son to restrain him, when he heard what the jailer said, he cried out and beat his head, although he was at death's door, and raised himself upon his elbow and sent for some of his guards and commanded them to kill Antipater without tiny further delay, and to do it presently, and to bury him in an ignoble manner at Hyrcania. End quote. Herod, Josephus further tells us, died 5 days after he had ordered the execution of his eldest son. Josephus further notes that Herod showed his love for Rome to the end, for he, quote, bequeathed also to Caesar 10 millions of drachmae of coin money, besides both vessels of gold and silver and garments exceeding costly to Julia Caesar's wife, and to certain others 5 millions, end quote. Thus we have, in a fascinating but horrifying scene, an inability on the part of Herod to relinquish power, clashing with an inextinguishable quest for power of Prince Antipater. Had Antipater, Herod's oldest son, merely waited in prison, had he not been so eager for the throne, had he merely sought to first ascertain whether his father was indeed dead, he might well have not only survived, but perhaps succeeded in taking the throne for himself. In the play Henry IV, Prince Harry, the future Henry V, was mistakenly thought by his father to have seized the crown, but in fact, Harry had thought that his father had passed away. And it was the prince's awe and humility at the responsibility embodied by the crown that, for Shakespeare, reveals him to be worthy to rule. Here, in our story, we find the reverse. Antipater also thought his father dead, but his rush to seize power proved his own unworthiness for the crown and brought about his own undoing. In Shakespeare's play, Henry IV longs for a worthy heir. Herod, in contrast, even when he was dying, could not in any way tolerate the quest for power of another and sought to eliminate his own son, even when he, Herod, had only days to live. Herod's grip on power consumed his life at all times. Thus did Josephus conclude his description of the king. Quote, a man he was of great barbarity towards all men equally and a slave to his passion, but above the consideration of what was right. Yet was he favored by fortune as much as any man ever was, for from a private man he became a king, and though he were encompassed with 10,000 dangers, he got clear of them all, and continued his life till a very old age. But then, as to the affairs of his family and children, in which indeed, according to his own opinion, he was also very fortunate, because he was able to conquer his enemies, yet, in my opinion, he was herein very unfortunate. End quote. Fascinatingly, at the end of Act 4, the dying King Henry IV asks about the appellation of one chamber in his palace. Quote, doth any name particular belong unto the lodging where I first did swoon? To this question the reply comes, 'Tis called Jerusalem, my noble lord. The room in the palace, in other words, where King Henry was about to die, was known as the Jerusalem room or the Jerusalem chamber. Henry IV had himself thought that he would travel to Jerusalem, but he had never made the trip, so focused had he been on removing threats to his throne. And he therefore, in the play, reflects at the end of his life upon the symbolism of the moment, saying, quote, "Laud be to God, even there my life must end. It hath been prophesied to me many years I should not die but in Jerusalem, which vainly I supposed the Holy Land, but bear me to that chamber, there I'll lie, in that Jerusalem shall Harry die." End quote. Thus King Henry IV was taken into the Jerusalem chamber, and there his reign came to a close. For Shakespeare, Marjorie Garber writes, this is meant to be a biblical allusion. As she puts it, quote, "Henry's death in the Jerusalem chamber has some affinities with the death of Moses, who led the Israelites to the mountaintop and glimpsed the promised land, but could not enter it. It is Hal, not his father, who will complete the journey." Garber's political point, I think, is that for Shakespeare, a king must see himself as part of a larger chain. But I would also suggest that another possible point to be made here is that Jerusalem's allure has always been, in part, its embodying a source of power that is greater than anything on earth, a source of power that frustrates the plans for power of kings and commoners alike. Henry IV died in the Jerusalem chamber, and Herod died in the actual Jerusalem. But the mysterious, enduring allure of Jerusalem itself would remain long after both these kings had disappeared from the earth. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.